Right, so we start with a retraction. In which year did the Second World War end? And this is quite controversial, what we said here, and quite a lot of correspondence, particularly on the website Flashy.
Well, the suggestion, it really is a pedantic suggestion, but was that we never formally made peace with Germany, because by the time the peace accord came along in 1947 in Paris, there was no entity called Germany. So it wasn't possible to conclude a treaty with
Germany. Do you mean there were two Germanies?
Because there were two components.
Exactly. Well, I think it was actually that it was later than that, wasn't it? That the peace treaty wasn't signed until 1950 with Italy, Romania, Hungary, Bulgaria, Finland was 1950. All the allies except Russia signed a treaty with Japan in 1951. Austria waited until 1955 to regain its sovereignty. But because Germany was divided, the bit of Germany that was controlled by the USSR, basically Russia didn't play ball with any of these treaties. And it's the confusion, I think, derives from the fact that people are assuming that what we meant was that no surrender document had been signed, and that absolutely had been signed. Hostilities had ceased.
Yeah, but it says here that East Germany only came into being in 1949. So what is the peace accord of 1950? What's that called? Is there a name for that? The Treaty of...
I think there were lots of individual ones that were signed.
Okay, so by that time, East Germany was in existence and didn't sign anything.
Yeah.
So I think that's pretty clear cut then. So we don't want
the
to
point
retract
is
that
it's, it's it, what we're the point about it, why it's a technicality and why it's interesting is at all. I think is just that the formal conclusion of peace is legally documented. And actually, I think you probably find that there are still some interesting open-ended. For example, there was no formal declarations of war. The United States has now pretty much decided not to declare war on anyone formally. They've only declared war, well, you say only, 11 times. Which I love, mostly against
Mexico.
Yeah, Mexico, Spain, Japan, Italy, Bulgaria, Romania, United Kingdom in 1812, extraordinarily, and against Hungary twice in its guise 1917, in its guise as Austria-Hungary, and in 1942 again, the Second World War.
So how often have they declared war on Iraq?
Well, no, the Vietnam War and the two Iraq campaigns were not formal declarations of war. They're now called military engagements authorized by Congress. And since 1973, the War Powers Act, the president can deploy troops within certain limits without a formal declaration. So formal declarations, they don't like them because they tend to lend legitimacy to unrecognized, unpopular regimes. So if you declare war against, Saddam Hussein, it's almost like you're bigging him up in a way. The Korean War was neither formally declared nor approved by Congress, and despite hostilities ending in 1953, they've never signed a peace treaty. So we're still, you could say, legally, technically, America is still at war with Korea.
Conversely, there's a thing mentioned by Jeremy Hardy in one of the shows about how the only war that's been declared between two democracies is the one between Britain and, I think it's Finland, during the Second World War.
Really?
Yes.
And
very interesting.
And that had the strangest thing to feature, which is we never actually went and fought them.
No.
So the one war that has been declared is the one where nobody shot a single shot.
I love Ambrose Bierce's line that war is God's way of teaching Americans geography.
That's very good. Now, just going back to this retraction briefly, which is since they can't answer back, DJ Gordy on the website says that he criticises the point by saying, according to Wikipedia, East Germany came into being in 1949. Now, as we know, Wikipedia, the elves are always commanded or never to accept Wikipedia's word for anything, so we have only Wikipedia perhaps to thank for that. Perhaps that's not fair, but as he can't answer back, ha 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 ha. Here's an interesting thing I bet you don't know about peace. The Encyclopedia Britannica, when it was in what's the book called that's not virtual?
In its real kind of...
Well, what's that called?
A hard copy.
Hard copy.
Yeah.
Offline.
The Encyclopedia Britannica is only online now, but in the days when it was a book in the late 90s, and I've still got a copy of that, a full set, Macropedia and Micropedia, it has... the Encyclopedia Britannica has three entries under the title War, various kinds of war, running to 167 pages in all, but it has no entry under the word peace. There isn't one. It doesn't say what peace is in the Encyclopaedia Britannica. And the general entry on war leads to two long articles on war, the technology of, and war, the theory and conduct of. And you can also inform yourself on war, a just war, the law of, war, prisoner of, war communism, war crime, war democrat, war finance, war hawk, war of, and war of the sons of light against the sons of darkness. Under peace, you have to make do with peace, disturbing the, peace, justice of the, peace corps, peace democrat, peace mission, and peace of. So that it hardly does, and one of them is peacemaker, which is an intercontinental ballistic missile. So it's a fascinating thing. It goes, Heraclitus said, the world began in war and will end in war. And it is fascinating. We'll disapprove of war, but we find it much more interesting than peace. And in fact, there's nothing to say about peace. I mean, nothing happens in peace. Is that boring?
No, I think it's great. That's very interesting.
It's just an interesting thing where very detailed research of that kind fades, you know, shades off into philosophy and mysticism. It's one thing that's always fascinated me is why do people like murder mysteries so much? Mm. Most people wouldn't dream of killing somebody, but they love reading about people being killed. Guillotines. A note on guillotines here. We had some correspondence with a Miss Jouery who said that Stephen en passant mentions that the guillotine was invented in 1792, I think he says, which is...
I think first used in 1792.
Used in 1792, but in fact, it predates that. It was the guillotine as such, I think, arrived... Was it 1792? Was it 1789?
Well, 1789. Dr. Joseph Ignace Guillotin put to the National Assembly his plan to reform the penal system and make it more humane, and that was when the idea. But actually, the first one wasn't made until 1792.
Very good. I remember.
And it wasn't called a guillotine.
It was called a louisette.
Yeah.
But our correspondent is saying that the guillotine wasn't, she says, was not invented in 1789 or 1792. It's much older and not even French, which is, in fact, the thing we knew, in fact.
It's true and much more interesting.
But it wasn't called a guillotine.
No, it was called the Halifax gibbet or the maiden in Scotland.
Yeah, but you've just said it wasn't called the guillotine even in 1792.
It was first called the Louison Louisette, but it rapidly became called the guillotine.
And nobody really knows why.
The sad
truth about this is the guillotine was a great humane kind of penal reformer who disliked intensely all forms of capital punishment. All he was saying is if you're going to have a form of execution,
right,
you'd have one that didn't discriminate against the poor, because what happened at this time, the poor were hanged messily in an unpleasant way, whereas the rich were beheaded cleanly. So he said, why don't we have for the new democracy that we're trying to build, why don't we build a proper machine to do it? And that was how, in the end, I suppose, the name got attached to him. But his family fought for generations afterwards to try and get their name removed
from the machine. Yeah. It wasn't, but you're right, he was.
Wasn't guillotined, was he? He died from...
No, he died of a carbuncle on the shoulder. But the point being, for somebody who doesn't know this, is why execution, which sounds, I think, to us more hideous than hanging. The point was that even if you took, you know, most people were cleanly beheaded in one stroke, but sometimes there was a few. But with hanging, there are two kinds of hanging, the short drop and the long drop. And with the short drop, for example, you'd be put on top of a cart and pushed off a cart. Mm. And it often wasn't far enough to break your neck or suffocate you, and you would hang there for ages, sometimes with your relatives pulling on your feet, trying to kill you, because you were slowly choking to death.
Much as you see in those rather grotesque scenes of public execution still today in places like Iran, where they're just hoisted onto the back of cranes.
Yeah. And similarly, conversely, the long drop method of hanging, where they got the idea that falling off a cart wasn't going to kill you very quickly, with the long drop, hideous things would happen, that your head would pop off.
Which happened to the chap in Iraq recently.
Did it?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Well, except for unless you had a very good executioner. It was always the apocryphal story about Pierpoint. It was that he could judge the weight of a man by the prisoner who he was going to execute by shaking his hand. He could figure out roughly how long to leave the rope so that you would get a clean break of the... snaps the spinal cord by extending the vertebrae rather than, so you die instantaneously.
So the point was that we didn't specifically say, well, certainly none of the research team claimed that the guillotine was invented in...
Or a decapitating machine was invented.
You know, we did know that, but thanks to Fred and to Miss Jury for trying to pull us up on it, but actually we think we are right, because at the very least, the guillotine in inverted commas might have been invented.
The nice story from Halifax that I've always liked is that it was the merchants in Halifax, big clothing town, and the problem that they had was that that tenting, in order to dry your cloths once they'd been dyed, you'd leave them outside to dry, and they were being nicked all the time. So they basically decided, the good gentlemen of Halifax decided they needed a deterrent, and it was a monk, a feet friar, who came and invented this engine, or gin as it was known, which was capable of cutting off the heads of valiant rogues without the direct intervention of human hands. So as they were rather sort of kind of lily-livered merchants, they didn't want to actually wield the axe themselves.
I do have one retraction on this subject, however, Mr. Chairman, if I may, which is that Stephen says that Jim Dale in Carry On, Don't Lose Your Head says as he's about to be guillotined, someone comes along and says, there's a note to you from Robespierre, and he says, leave it in the basket, I'll read it later on. In point of fact, that wasn't Jim Dale, but Charles Hawtrey.
Ah, very good.
That's the kind of fascinating detail, Flashy, that makes life worth living on QR.
Nobody knows how long the severed head remains conscious.
But I just like... No, you're right.
5 and 10... So they say it could be as long as 13 seconds, which is, you know, if you think about it, quite a long time to be staring out of a basket.
Well, also, the question is, does consciousness survive death? Many people think that it does. Oh, including yes. Garrick, as you know, having had an out-of-body experience. So it's perfectly possible that the head may stop working, but you're floating above it, being able to read the note in the basket.
You get making Flash very nervous now, John. I can feel he's kind of starting to exhale.
Perhaps he's no longer conscious. My God, he's gone. Right, now, the invention of marking. This is a question that I'm responsible for, so rightly or wrongly, I take full blame or full credit. I read this in a wonderful book that I can recommend to anyone, Technopoly by Neil Postman, which is an extremely good book about how technology doesn't necessarily improve our lives. And this, the idea that marking papers was invented in 1792 by this chap, William Farish, professor of chemistry at Cambridge and vicar of St. Giles. And the contention was that this is around the time of the Industrial Revolution beginning, and that his great insight was that instead of a very long-winded oral examination, if he got people to write it down and to give it a numerical score, he could get through about 15 times as many students' work. And because the teachers in those days were paid, as a result of the Industrial Revolution and sort of new ways of doing things, they were paid on piecework. And I contend that this is, in fact, true, that numerical scores were not given. What I did not mean, or did not mean, Stephen, to say, was that this was the invention of exams. There have all been exams, as is well known, as Suze very correctly points out, going way, way back to the time of Christ, the Chinese civil service exam. The Chinese and the English, incidentally, are the two cultures in the world who are keenest on exams, and always have been. There's a great affinity there, interestingly. No other cultures are nearly so keen on things. But I do maintain that giving a numerical score as an 89% or a 34% was actually invented by Farish in 1792. And I don't think that anything Suze says in her attempt to get us a retraction goes against that.
No, but it does give us access to this quite interesting topic of the Chinese civil service exam.
It's very interesting. And Suze, who is an absolutely top person, this is really good, Flash. Tell us about the subjects in Chinese exams.
I just want to say, quite right, Suze is a very well-informed and helpful poster on the website. And she draws our attention to the Chinese civil service exam, and which we know has existed for about 2,000 years. It was established around the time of Christ. And there was a written syllabus on archery, riding, mathematics, music, writing, and technical knowledge of the civil service. And it was used as a way of getting access to the civil service, and was really the only way to achieve promotion on merit.
But I think the point being that, as far as I know anyway, as with, you know, viva voce oral exams, that the basic point of these things was, is this person now qualified to teach this, to understand it, to practice it? So that it would be much more that, having done the exam, you have now passed, that you're good enough. If you're not good enough, you have to go back and do it again. Or alternatively, you know, but it wouldn't be saying that this person is 2% better than that person. I don't think that's ever, you know, either you can ride a horse sufficiently well to be a qualified riding instructor, or you can't. It wouldn't be scored.
Yeah.
But anyway, by the 6th century, 6 more subjects have been added, it says here.
Well, yeah.
What were they?
Accounting, agriculture, geography, law, military strategy, and Confucius.
Very good.
And what I think is interesting is that apparently by the middle of the... about the 14th century in Western terms, candidates were placed in isolation cells for 72 hours during these exams, and they lived in there for 3 days, and they had to complete all the papers over those 3 days.
That's fantastic.
And the other thing was that there was a special sort of system of objectivity built in, because China's always been bedeviled by this thing of people fixing things for their nephew and all that. And students for this exam didn't write their names on the scripts at all, but a code number. And... The people who are marking the scripts didn't have any access to the list which identified whose code number belonged to which candidate. And in fact, it went further than that, so that in case the examiners recognized the handwriting of one of the candidates, the completed scripts were transcribed by a third party before being marked, so as to eliminate the possibility of a fudge.
That is thorough, isn't it?
Yeah,
that
it really is
seriously thorough. Good old Chinese.